There's a quote carved into the new Martin Luther King Jr. Memorial on the National Mall. I was a drum major for justice, peace, and righteousness. Except, as poet Maya Angelou pointed out this week, it's not a quote. It's a concentrated paraphrase that takes a word here and there from a speech that begins with Dr. King saying he didn't want to be lauded. But if you want to say that I was a drum major, he began, say that I was a drum major for justice. Ms. Angelou, the consultant to the memorial, said the words as chiseled, quote, makes Dr. Martin Luther King look like an arrogant twit. The if clause that's left out is salient. Leaving it out changes the meaning completely. The memorial's chief architect told NPR that the quote was a paraphrase of the original statement based on design constraints, meaning, I suppose, hey, there's only so much room on the wall. Even in these days of multiplying media platforms, there's only so much room on the wall. Excerpts are often reduced to clips, bites, and tweets, and quotes get transformed to fit or get attention. But this isn't new. Leo Durocher didn't say nice guys finish last, although he'd like to note that quote put him in Bartlett's between two British poets. He saw the 1948 New York Giants take the field and told a sports writer, they're all nice guys, but they'll finish last. The sports writer, or, as reporters prefer to think, an editor, squashed the sentences together to turn a pennant prediction into character judgment. Edmund Kean, the celebrated 19th century Shakespearean actor, is often quoted as saying on his deathbed, dying is easy, comedy is hard. In fact, it was uttered by Edmund Gwenn, the 20th century actor best known for playing Santa Claus in Miracle on 34th Street. But it sounds more profound as the final breath of a man who played Hamlet, not Kris Kringle. Another inscription on the Martin Luther King Jr. Memorial quotes him as saying, the arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends toward justice. President Obama even has this sentence sewn into the rug of the Oval Office as a quotation from Dr. King. It was actually said by the Reverend Theodore Parker, the Boston abolitionist who died in 1860. Dr. King, an eloquent man who appreciated how hard it is to write a memorable line, always cited Reverend Parker. But as they said in The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance, when the legend becomes the fact, print the legend. When the architect of the King Memorial was asked if he would change the quotation, he said, it's already set in stone. And you're listening to NPR News.
Sarah Palin's travels are yet another sign, like it or not, that the political season is upon us. And with it, of course, comes the media circus. We want to get a handle on what's happening in the media world and take a closer look at how the media works, all in the midst of rapidly changing times. We've asked NPR's media correspondent David Folkenflik to be our guide. He's in our New York City bureau, and he's here to offer up what he calls the news tip. And David, what do you mean by the news tip?
Well, the news tip is a bunch of things. It could be media criticism. It's a moment to consider first principles and how the news business operates. I may point out an example of a recurring flaw or a shout out to somebody who's doing something particularly well or, you know, a howler. Whatever it is, I want to be offering with you a word to the wise, not just to the journalists, but often it'll be to our listeners, to readers and viewers, consumers and citizens.
So, David, news tip number one.
News tip number one, this tip's for reporters. And the point is, cover the facts, not just the opinion. Here's a perfect example. There's been a lot of coverage lately of Texas Governor Rick Perry, who's seeking to become the Republican nominee in next year's presidential race. He's been talking a fair amount about global warming, climate change. Here's what he said in a recent speech.
I do believe that the issue of global warming has been politicized. I think there are a substantial number of scientists who have manipulated data so that they will have dollars rolling into their projects.
So this speech and others drew a lot of coverage, and a lot of it has been framed as what he's doing politically. It's framed about how he's positioning himself against other Republican candidates such as Mitt Romney. What you're not hearing, the hole at the middle of that donut, is the question of what the facts are. I've seen stories in ABC, USA Today, the Boston Globe, and many others, and they don't talk about that. But the facts are that the overwhelming consensus of the scientific community is that global warming is real, and that much of it, at least, is man-made.
But this is such a political topic. I mean, I think for reporters, it's difficult, right? I mean, you basically want to avoid that part of the conversation.
Right. It's a lot easier to sort of sidestep it and say, I can leave that to the science desk. But what you're really doing is outsourcing certain kinds of fundamental building blocks of reporting. After all, there are now these fact-checking outfits like PolitiFact and FactCheck.org that take on certain kinds of assertions by politicians and really unpack them and say, here's the evidence and here's what the facts show. But in reality, most people reading stories aren't going to absorb whether or not certain assertions have validity to them if people don't add the sentence or two that says what the scientific community actually believes.
So, David, while we're talking about presidential politics, I want to talk about last week's dust-up between President Obama and House Speaker John Boehner over when the president would give his speech to a joint meeting of Congress. Now, this seems like total inside baseball, but it was a big story going into the holiday. I mean, what's the news tip here?
Well, the news tip is just because the politicians look small doesn't mean that the media won't look petulant for covering it, too. I mean, this was, just as you say, an enormous story for several days, and it's evaporated. The White House basically struck a deal. They had wanted it on a Wednesday, which would have been, as it turns out, the same day as a Republican primary debate on cable. They'll have it on a Thursday, which it turns out is the same day as the kickoff for the NFL regular season. There's this kabuki theater going on. But, I mean, I think we've been reminded in recent days, a report showed that there had been zero jobs created functionally in the last month. There are a lot more serious issues on the plate that should probably be dominating the front pages. It makes for good signs of the political dysfunction in Washington. But a front page story? Really?
All right. Okay. So lastly, you wanted to tip people off to a little story in the New York Post.
Yeah. And I like this tip a lot. It's the third news tip of the day. That is, more reporting is always the best antidote to poor reporting. Here in New York City, The Post reported that Congresswoman Michelle Bachmann of Minnesota, who is also a candidate for president in the Republican Party, had been receiving financial support from Jewish donors who mistakenly thought, because of her name, that she was Jewish.
Hmm.
So Washington Post media blogger Eric Wemple thought that was kind of dubious, as he told me when we spoke recently.
I just wanted to give the New York Post a little hand in trying to confirm the story, so I started calling around to GOP Jewish donors and the Jewish donors on Michelle Bachmann's own rolls to see if I could confirm this notion that somehow they thought that she was Jewish.
And by giving them a hand, you mean deeply mortify, right?
Well, you know, I'm sticking with my talking points here. I'm part of the media brotherhood. When I see another outlet that is a little weak on sourcing, well, I just try to get in and row.
And, you know, to invoke a Yiddish term, what Eric Wemple got when trying to confirm that was bupkis. He couldn't find any Jewish donors who had felt that they had been misled somehow, that Michelle Bachmann, who is an outspoken evangelical Christian, was anything but who she was. She's also a strong supporter of the State of Israel. A lot of Orthodox Jews felt simpatico with her views. In this story, it seemed to me that he sort of mockingly did the original reporting. It would have been nice for the Post to do itself.
NPR's media correspondent David Folkenflik, thank you so much for talking with us.
Hey, you bet.
And if you want more of David's news, tips, wisdom, or want to send your own tips in, hit him up on Twitter, at David Folkenflik.
The Big Dipper has a shiny new sequin on its handle. It's a supernova, the magnificent last hurrah of a star. This weekend's a rare opportunity for amateurs to see a supernova from Earth. People all over the country will be able to catch a glimpse of the fireball from their backyards as it reaches peak brightness over the next few nights. Peter Nugent is an astronomer at Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory in California. He joins us from a studio there. Dr. Nugent, thanks for being with us.
Thank you very much for having me, Scott.
How often does this happen?
So in a galaxy like the Milky Way, about once every 100 years, we can expect one of these supernova.
How bright is it going to be?
So this supernova will reach what we in astronomy call 10th magnitude, and that's about 100 times fainter than the human eye can see unaided in a dark sky, but easily reachable with a very small telescope.
And if we have such a telescope, how do we find it?
So the easiest way to find it is to look for the Big Dipper, mm-hmm. head to the last two stars in the handle of the Big Dipper, and make an equilateral triangle out of those two stars with a point heading north, and the host galaxy for the supernova, the Pinwheel Galaxy, is located right at the other end of that triangle.
So we can't miss it?
Well, it's probably best to get a star map out just to make sure you're in the neighborhood, but the Pinwheel Galaxy is pretty easy to see. It's about 3/4 the size of the full moon, and it'll look like a nice fuzzy patch in a small 6-inch telescope.
And how far away is it from us?
Our best measurement to date places it about 21 million light years away.
Is it true that the light we're going to be seeing is from a star that has already burned out?
Already dead and gone. If we were sitting in the Pinwheel Galaxy now, there would be nothing left of this supernova. Everything would that came from the explosion spread out everywhere.
There's something very poignant about that.
Yeah, that we're actually looking at something that's already dead and gone and vanished, but we get to watch it 21 million light years away and 21 million years later.
And how long will this light show last?
That's the incredible part. This supernova will reach peak brightness next Thursday, September 8th, and will be visible in small telescopes for the next year. And then by then, you'll start to need about a 1-meter telescope, professional-class telescope, to follow it up. But then even the Hubble Space Telescope will still be able to view it for 2 to 3 more years after that. So this is one that's going to be studied for many, many years.
Dr. Nugent, thanks so much.
Thank you very much for having me.
Peter Nugent, an astronomer at Lawrence Berkeley National Lab, speaking to us from Berkeley. This is NPR News. Justin Torres's debut novel is a welterweight champ of a book. Short, at just 125 pages, but taut, elegant, sinewy and lean, and it delivers a knockout. We the Animals tells the story of three boys growing up in upstate New York as told through the eyes of the youngest son. Their parents started having babies as Brooklyn teenagers. They work hard, Ma on a brewery's night shift, Pops does odd jobs and drives a truck, but they're poor. Their boys always seem to scramble and scrap for more food, a little attention, a little more joy. Both the boys and their parents smack each other brutally and rely only on each other, utterly. The story is told in a series of scenes that burst open like exploding stars, full of violence and light. We the Animals is the first novel by Justin Torres, who grew up in upstate New York. He's a graduate of the Iowa Writers' Workshop. Joins us in our studios. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you. Thanks for that wonderful introduction.
Well, the book deserves it.
Thank you.
Is this your story?
It is loosely based on my own autobiography. So I have two brothers. My mother worked in a brewery. My parents were teenagers when they started having kids. But the incidents are fiction. I wanted to make myth out of family. I wanted to get to an emotional truth that I think fiction can really deliver.
As we noted, this book is, I mean, it's like a diamond, brilliant and brilliantly compressed. But have you been writing it like all your life?
I have. I've been, ever since I kind of started writing, I started late, in my mid-20s. It's been 5 or 6 years that I've been working on this book until I got to this simple and clear and precise and concise as I could.
I want to get you to expand on that wonderful phrase where you refer to the brothers as the three-torsoed beast.
Yeah, I think that there's a kind of pack mentality that really close brothers can have, and there's a way in which they can communicate non-verbally and almost behave as just one being, understanding each other's impulses and instincts. And I think that the brothers in this book do that. They run around, and they just get each other. As they move into adolescence, it becomes more necessary and more difficult to communicate verbally.
Yeah. The book grabs you from the first line, so why don't we ask you to read those first lines, if you could.
I'd love to. We wanted more. We knocked the butt ends of our forks against the table, tapped our spoons against our empty bowls. We were hungry. We wanted more volume, more riots. We turned up the knob on the TV until our ears ached with the shouts of angry men. We wanted more music on the radio. We wanted beats. We wanted rock. We wanted muscles on our skinny arms. We had bird bones, hollow and light, and we wanted more density, more weight. We were six snatching hands, six stomping feet. We were brothers, boys, three little kings locked in a feud for more. When it was cold, we fought over blankets until the cloth tore down the middle. When it was really cold, when our breath came out in frosty clouds, Manny crawled into bed with Joel and me. Body heat, he said. Body heat, we agreed. We wanted more flesh, more blood, more warmth. When we fought with boots and garage tools, snapping pliers. We grabbed at whatever was nearest and we hurled it through the air. We wanted more broken dishes, more shattered glass. We wanted more crashes.
That phrase, we were like three little kings feuding for more.
Yeah, it's definitely, you have to assert your little fiefdom within the home and make sure that you rule over your space. Otherwise, it will get usurped pretty quickly.
So why are the brothers always wrestling, gouging, and smacking each other?
You know, there's, I think boys are just inherently exuberant, but there is a lot of passion among the parents and between the parents that is being absorbed, yeah. I think, by the brothers. And, you know, when you see a lot of kind of violent passion, you enact a lot of violent passion as a child.
We'll explain. Ma is white, father is Puerto Rican, and they love each other. They can't keep their hands off each other. But sometimes they can't keep their hands off each other in the worst way, too.
Yeah. I mean, they were teenagers when they started this endeavor of raising three boys, and they're maybe not as well-equipped as they could be. And then they have this overriding passion that makes them wild.
Why is your book so short?
I think that the book is so short because of the way that I write. I kind of write sentence by sentence, and I make sure that I have the exact right phrasing and structure and syntax within the sentence before moving on to the next one. It takes forever. And I think that I just have a real attraction to precise, stripped-down, clear language. I think that another reason is that when I started, I was working all of these odd jobs. I was still walking dogs or, you know, working in bookstores or whatever. And so I didn't have a lot of time and leisure to just sit and write. You know, I had to get to the point and get to the heat as quickly as possible.
I wonder if you can do another reading on page 2 through to the end of that paragraph.
Okay. And when our pops came home, we got spankings. Our little round butt cheeks were tore up, red, raw, leather whipped. We knew there was something on the other side of the pain, on the other side of the sting. Prickly heat radiated upward from our thighs and backsides. Fire consumed our brains. But we knew that there was something more, some place our pops was taking us with all this. We knew because he was meticulous, because he was precise, because he took his time. He was awakening us. He was leading us somewhere beyond burning and ripping, and you couldn't get there in a hurry.
What's it like for your father to read that?
I don't know. I'm sure I'm going to hear about it soon. I hope that I have shown a compassionate enough picture here of a father who is not my father, but, you know, there are certain similarities. I hope that that's something he appreciates.
Well, Justin Torres' widely lauded debut novel, We the Animals. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
And you can read an excerpt from Justin Torres' novel on our website, npr.org.
The facts of 9/11 are irrefutable. The planes crashed, the World Trade Center towers collapsed, thousands died. But facts alone never tell the whole story. In the search for meaning, we often turn to those who write fiction because writers keep looking for the truth, even when they know they don't have all the answers. NPR's Lynn Neary has this report on the literature of 9/11.
Writer Colin McCann had a very personal connection to the tragedy of 9/11. His father-in-law was in the first building to be hit.
He got out and he walked up through the streets of New York and came to our apartment, and my daughter Isabella jumped up into his arms and she smelled the smoke on his clothes and she thought he was burning. And I said to her, no, love, he's not burning, because he's just there was a fire downtown. And she said to me, "Ah, no, Dad, but he's burning from the inside out." And it was one of those moments where I thought, aha, you know, I'm going to have to write about this. I'm going to have to deal with this.
It would be 5 years before McCann would begin writing what would become his 9/11 novel, Let the Great World Spin. Julia Glass couldn't wait that long.
9/11 happened to my novel as much as it happened to me.
Glass had already started a book about a group of people who lived in New York. The action was taking place in the years 2000 and 2001.
So I was faced with dropping the novel, relocating it to Kalamazoo, which obviously I wasn't going to do. And at the same time, I went through what a lot of fiction writers in New York and elsewhere went through at the time, which is that I couldn't write.
Glass had to overcome the feeling that writing fiction seemed absurd and narcissistic. When she did start writing again, she knew the events of that day had to become part of the story of her novel the whole world over. Joseph O'Neill had a similar experience. He had been writing a book about the little-known world of cricket players in New York. O'Neill's book Netherland is the story of a man who discovers that hidden world when his life falls apart after September 11th, 2001.
Your decision isn't so much to write about 9/11, because that's a sort of paralyzing, petrifying prospect. It's more to undertake a kind of exploration of the experience. And so it's, in my case at least, and I think in the case of most novelists around that time, you don't have a thesis or a massive insight you wish to share. You simply want to use the writing process in the book as a means of trying to come to terms with it.
There were so many witnesses to the events of 9/11, says O'Neill, that merely trying to describe what happened is a challenge for the writer.
Everyone has their opinions about it, and everyone has their experiences of it. There are millions and millions of personal stories about 9/11, which people tell themselves all the time. I suppose it's difficult, in the midst of all this massive and frantic narrative competition, to say something in a way that hasn't been said before, that doesn't feel superfluous or exploitative.
Now, 10 years later, says O'Neill, 9/11 is so much a part of the landscape that you can write a novel about it without ever even referring to 9/11. That's exactly what Colin McCann did. His novel, Let the Great World Spin, is set in the 1970s, on the day that tightrope walker Philippe Petit pranced between the towers of the World Trade Center.
I thought, well, because he created this walk and he created this moment of beauty, it sort of stood in a really fine opposition to the destruction, the idea of the towers coming down and all that, you know, ash and dust. And so I thought it would work in that sort of, in a counterbalance way.
Just as the horror of 9/11 was an event that pulled the world together for a day, so does this extraordinary high-wire act link the characters in McCann's novel. In the image of a man balancing delicately on a cable high above the city, he finds a metaphor for survival.
I wanted to talk about the man who didn't fall in order to try and get at these issues of grace and these issues of recovery and these issues of, you know, the world actually going on.
It is that very act of persevering, says Julia Glass, that fiction can capture so powerfully.
A passenger jet against a beautiful blue sky will always, always make me think of 9/11. And that's a shame, but life changes. So what the fiction writer does is write about, you know, not as the historian would, how do we make sense of this event, but what happens to our personal selves and what happens to our relationships and what happens to the way that we relate to the world that's different than it was before.
Some say the definitive 9/11 novel is still decades away. Joseph O'Neill doesn't think so. He says no one book will ever say it all.
It's not a puzzle that someone will crack and then the subject will then be closed. We have a continuing relationship with it now, and we will always have an organic and contested and ongoing relationship with it.
Just as the politics of 9/11 will reverberate for years, so will the stories echo around the globe, because the events of that day changed the world in ways we may never understand. Lynn Neary, NPR News, Washington.
Federal regulator has filed a lawsuit against 17 financial firms. Some of them, the biggest names on Wall Street. The suit alleges misrepresentation and negligence in the sale of mortgage securities. NPR's Chris Arnold reports.
Bank of America, J.P. Morgan Chase, Goldman Sachs, and others are being sued essentially for selling bad mortgages. The Federal Housing Finance Agency is suing on behalf of the government-backed firms Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, who bought the mortgages. Guy Sakala is the publisher of Inside Mortgage Finance.
This lawsuit is an attempt to recoup some of the losses Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac suffered from investing very heavily in subprime loans.
So this is basically investors, in this case Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, go to the major banks and say, hey, look, you sold us this stuff. You said it was AAA. You said it was great. And look, it was garbage and we lost billions of dollars.
Exactly.
Investors have filed many similar lawsuits before, but Fannie and Freddie bought a ton of bad loans. So Sakala says the liability could potentially be huge.
It's probably somewhere in the neighborhood of $30 to $50 billion. That is enough to break a number of these financial institutions in there.
But Sakala says the lawsuit could be a tough one to prove. Fannie and Freddie were certainly experienced investors who the banks could argue should have known exactly what they were buying. And the companies decided to take the risk of buying up all these subprime loans.
Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, again, very sophisticated investors, in many cases were able to underwrite and look at each loan going into the securities they were buying. So it's hard to make that case that they were duped.
Sakala says it's hard to estimate how substantial any settlement might be. Chris Arnold, NPR News.
You're listening to NPR News.